This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, and I'm Joe Palca. Later in the hour, we'll be talking about the science of epigenetics, a relatively new field that looks at non-traditional modes of inheritance. But first, a tribute.
Mr. Trouble never hangs around when he hears this mighty sound.
Here I come to save the day.
That means that Mighty Mouse.
In laboratories all over the world, the lab mouse, Mus musculus, is busy doing its thing, eating, sleeping, running on a metal wheel, rearranging the wood shavings in the cage, awaiting their turn to be guinea pigs, if you'll pardon the expression. By one estimate, 25 million lab mice are at work in the world, sitting in for humans in experiments meant to tell us more about human cancers, diabetes, Alzheimer's, even obesity. So how did this relationship develop? How is it that a tiny, furry rodent with a lifespan of less than 3 years came to be the model organism for human disease? That's what we'll be talking about this hour. If you want to join our conversation, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. If you want more information about what we'll be talking about this hour, go to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. And now, let me introduce my guests. Barbara Knowles is the Director of Research at the Jackson Laboratory in Bar Harbor, Maine. She joins us by phone from the lab. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Knowles.
Hi.
Hi. And Karen Rader is the Marilyn Simpson Chair of Science and Society at Sarah Lawrence College in Bronxville, New York. She is also the author of Making Mice, Standardizing Animals for American Biomedical Research, 1900 to 1955, just out by Princeton University Press. She joins me right here in the studio. Thanks for coming in today, Dr. Rader.
Hi, thanks very much.
Or if I may, Karen. So, Karen, so let's start with you here. Your book is really the story of Clarence Little.
That's right, that's right.
Tell us about him. Who is Clarence Little?
Well, first, let me end the suspense for anyone who's wondering. There's no relationship between Clarence Little and Stuart Little.
That was my next question. We spared it.
E.B. White and Clarence Little both have a main connection, but unfortunately, the most famous mouse in children's literature is not connected to this man.
Too bad.
Who was the great-great-grandson of Paul Revere, an old Boston Brahmin who went to Harvard in the 19-teens and majored in genetics, became a track star, and was a little bit obsessed with mice.
And so, what a strange thing. Was he a mouse fancier or a mouse scientist, or what was he?
He had connections with the fanciers. His father was a dog fancier, and he went to Harvard thinking that he was going to work on the genetics of dogs, you know, the sort of Westminster Kennel Club type thing. Mm-hmm. And got there, and a professor by the name of William Ernest Castle, so the story goes, slid a mouse, across a desk to him and told him he really should learn everything about mice. And the rest, as they say, is history. He became kind of interested, to use the word mildly, in looking at these mice, breeding them, finding out more about the genetics, first of their coat colors. So that's very much in line with what the group of mouse fanciers were doing at the time. Mm-hmm. And then he was noticing, and others were noticing, that these mice were getting cancer, in large part because they were being inbred, brother, sister.
Maybe we should say, what is a mouse fancier? I mean, what were these groups doing?
A mouse fancier is very much like a dog fancier. They keep mice as pets and take them around the country and around the world. This is something that's international. And to mouse shows. I think the last one in New York was in 1996. And the mice are judged on things like coat and the other ways that they look.
So they're like, there's best in show for mice.
That's right.
But it's interesting that Dr. Little was clearly, Clarence Little was clearly a scientist. Or
that's
was interested
right.
in from a scientific and a breeding point of view. But at least at the early stages, there was no conflict between the people who loved mice and bred them for, pets and show, with the people who were using them for research.
That's right. And in fact, there was a great deal of collaboration, both in terms of exchange of materials and in terms of some of the fanciers becoming interested in scientific questions. So, for example, the mouse geneticists would go to the mouse shows and judge the shows. And the people who sold mice to the mouse, to the mouse geneticists, would come and do research in scientific laboratories. The most famous of which is this woman, Abby Lathrop, of the Granby Mouse Farm.
Now, why, I mean, what was Clarence Little's goal in breeding mice? What did he want to achieve?
Well, I think it changed over time. I think at first he was interested in using the mouse as a model for studying human diseases, and that never really went away, but became a little more complicated as it became clear that mammalian genetics was more complicated than the genetics of a fruit fly. So you weren't going to be able to draw straightforward eugenic conclusions, if you will, from mice to humans. So at that point, then it became about looking at genetics in, for example, carcinogenesis, the development of tumors and susceptibility to tumors. So that was the real goal. But then the Jackson Lab kind of overtook that goal because they became interested in production of mice for other researchers, not just for the Jackson Lab's own projects.
And Dr. Little was the founder of or the originator
of
the Jackson Lab. So let's turn to Dr. Knowles at that point and say, why mice? Why did the? I mean, the Jackson Lab was started by Clarence Little as a way of providing mice for researchers, but
he founded the Jackson Lab to do research on the mice, and what we forgot to say is that the Jackson Laboratory opened in 1929. And the founder died that year, and the person who donated the majority of the cash to make this lab viable.
That was Roscoe Jackson?
Roscoe B. Jackson, right. And so he died, and the stock market crashed, and then there were all this little group of scientists here working away, and they had no source of income. So they tried farming, but I don't know if you've been in Maine often, but the first frost certainly comes in October, and the ground does not defrost until May. So farming is not a great option if you want to eat. So they were trying all different ways to make money, and one of the ways that they decided was they could sell mice to other researchers.
Right. I didn't mean to jump ahead. I know we're sort of jumping around in the story, but what makes the mouse a good subject for research? I mean, it is very different from human, of course. So why would you want to? What could you learn from studying a mouse?
Well, the genes are actually very identical to humans. It's the rest of the genome that's different and the control mechanisms that are different. So the genes are very, very similar between human and mouse. They have a lifespan that allows you to work with throughout the entire life of a mouse. So an ordinary mouse lives about 2.5 years. It's a long time to do an experiment, but it's not impossible. And you can't do experiments on people.
No, I see. And Clarence Little, as I understand it, was anxious to get inbred strains of mice because he thought that would provide a sort of a standard. Is that the case today? Are inbred strains mostly what people work with?
Oh, yes, they do work with inbred strains, but they work with mutations that are within inbred strains. So they are absolutely identical genetically except for one gene. Or then they also work with many multiple different strains, so that by comparing atherosclerosis in 30 different strains, you can find one that is susceptible and one that is resistant to getting that sort of disease. And then you can choose a model that you really would like to work with, try to figure out the genes that are different between these different inbred strains.
We're talking about the mouse as the model organism, the lab animal that scientists are very interested in studying. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's take a call now from June in Livonia, Michigan. June, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'd like to refer to the use of mice in cancer research.
Mm-hmm.
The percentage of Americans dying from cancer now is the same as in 1970 and in 1950. It seems like the American war on cancer has stalled. I have an article here from a medical publication, and the reason they give for this is the preclinical model scientists use for finding new drugs, the mouse, is woefully inadequate for determining whether a compound will work in humans. Despite their genetic and organ system similarities, the two species have key differences in physiology, tissue architecture, metabolic rate, immune system function, molecular signaling, etc.
Well, June, I think that's an interesting point, and I think we have to task Barbara Knowles with that. There's all sorts of stories of treatments for cancer that work in mice, and they only to fail in humans. How do you answer that question?
I think that the majority of the work that has been done that has developed the drugs and treatments for cancer that exist has been started in mice. That's actually why they started selling these mice in the 1930s. That was just when chemotherapy was coming online, and we do know that chemotherapy has saved thousands of lives over the time. I think the criticism, there was a big article recently using that kind of criticism, but I think the criticism was of the use of specific models for cancer research that are not the major models that are being used. People actually do live longer now, and they do get cancer later in life, and that is, I think, one of the reasons why the percentage of cancer has not changed.
Okay, June, thanks for that interesting call. Let's go to Linda in Sacramento, California. Linda, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I'm concerned that it's always the viewpoint of the human and not the animal. And the little mice are treated as though they're objects for our use. And we know, like the other caller said, that most of the research that's done is not human applicable. And it's very disturbing to me that the mice are not covered under the Human Welfare Act, or the Animal Welfare Act, sorry. Right. And so we always concern ourselves with the rights of humans, but not the little animals that we do anything we want to at any time. And they're little sentient beings just like we are. They have a central nervous system, a need for care, and they don't need to be given tumors or having horrible experiments done to them.
Right.
Yes.
No, I think, actually, Linda, I'm very glad you asked this question because it seems to me to be a central one. And before we start celebrating the mouse as this wonderful research tool, I think we have to address the points you raise. So thanks very much. I think you made your case, made the question very clearly. So can I turn to Karen Rader and say, how has this argument, it hasn't been a chronic one, because as we said early on, the breeders and the people who kept them as pets were the same, but it certainly has evolved. Where are we with this discussion of the value of mice as opposed to the harm, that's obviously done to them in some experiments?
This is an issue I was very interested in, and in my own research tried to pay careful attention to sort of when and where people were paying attention to mice, because the anti-vivisection movement in this country goes back to the 1890s and 1920s. Mice are a relatively recent entry into that debate, and I would say that's in large part because of the animal rights movement of the 60s and 70s. But even so, there was a 1999 survey taken by the NSF Science Indicators.
National Science Foundation.
That's right, uh-huh. Yeah. And that showed that 66% of Americans approve of mouse use in research, which is a much higher number. I don't remember the other numbers, but it's a much higher number than approve of animal models more broadly. So there's something about the mouse. It sits on this border between it's enough like us that the scientific conclusions apply to us, but not so much like us that it makes people uncomfortable. At least that's been the case for the period that I looked at. But, that said, recent events such as the suits against the USDA, yeah, which have been the
Department of Agriculture, which is in charge of protecting laboratory animals.
That's right. They administer the Animal Welfare Act, and there's been suits recently because when the act took effect in the early 60s, the head of the USDA decided sort of arbitrarily that mice, rats, and birds would not be covered.
Okay, we're going to have to take a short break, but we're going to continue our discussion of the mouse and the use of the mouse in research. Please stay with us. We'll be talking mouse and mouse research when we come back. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm Joe Pelka. We're talking this hour about the history of the lab mouse. My guests are Barbara Knowles, the Director of Research at the Jackson Laboratory in Bar Harbor, Maine. She joins us by phone. And Karen Rader is the Marilyn Simpson Chair of Science and Society at Sarah Lawrence College and author of Making Mice, Standardizing Animals for American Biomedical Research, 1900 to 1955. And she's here in the studio. And before our break, we were talking about The protections that currently exist regulated by the U.S. Department of Agriculture for laboratory mice and laboratory animals, and the question is, do they extend to laboratory mice, and should they be stricter, and where do we stand with that?
I think, as I was saying, I think there have been efforts to broaden that coverage, and I think there's been a lot of resistance from the scientific community. In part because I think both sides on this debate, although I'm not thinking of a particular scientist, but I'm thinking of just sort of general positions, tend to characterize the other side. And so, for example, many scientists are worried about absurd regulations such as, you know, one mouse per cage. That might be appropriate for other kinds of mammals, but for mice it's not necessary and would completely throw the economy of research out the window, right? Because you'd have to have a lot more space and a lot more different procedures for breeding mice. So I mean, that said, that discussion, while that's an understandable worry from the scientific community's perspective, I think there's a lot of frustration from people who are sort of generally interested in opening up this discussion when it's been closed for so long and so arbitrarily. So I think we're at a moment now where there's an opportunity where it could be opened up, and it would have to be a good faith effort on the part of both sides. But I think we're sort of at a moment where it could happen and probably should happen because it's been closed off for so long.
So Barbara Doles, maybe I can turn to you. I mean, is there a change, do you feel, that's necessary in the way we think about using laboratory animals for research, especially the mouse?
I think that the Animal Welfare Act, we actually are under guidelines that are more stringent than the Animal Welfare Act. Each and every institution in the United States who works with mice must have an institutional animal care and use committee, and they look at each and every experiment that is proposed and decide whether the health or the welfare of the animals will be impinged upon by the experimental protocol, and they can actually change the protocols so that until they're comfortable. These committees always have a member of the public on the board, and they are really quite stringent examining what you're doing with an animal in an experiment. We also were doing animal husbandry and health research here, and we make sure that, and we're trying to set the standards for the entire nation.
You know, this is one of those questions that I think there are certain extreme positions on, and some people say never, under no circumstances, shouldn't be done, end of story. And for that kind of an argument, I don't think there's much to talk about. But I take it as given that scientists feel that the value in terms of curing human disease makes it worthwhile to use mice. Is that right, Dr. Knowles?
I think that it is, and it's actually one of those things I'm particularly sensitive to, ethical issues in animal research. And I think that that is the overwhelming feeling, at least in the United States, and I think it actually is even in Europe, where there is more of an outcry over the use of animals.
Okay. Let's take some calls. Our number here is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And let's go to Mike in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you. I was just wondering about the current studies on rat genomes versus mouse genomes and how the rat may be more beneficial than the mouse or vice versa. Could you clarify that? I'll take my answer off there. Thank you.
Oh, thanks, Mike. What about that, Dr. Knowles? Mouse genome largely completed, rat genome underway, mm-hmm. One more valuable than the other?
Well, I think that a lot of people feel that it would be very wonderful to be able to work on rats because rats have been a model organism for a very long time, especially in behavioral research and things like that. And the genome is becoming available, but the amount of genetic information that's known on the mouse is just astronomical. That's the first thing. And the second, and although it could be in the rat, but it just isn't at this moment. But what is really the difference is that we have, with the mouse, a way to make mutations within a given gene within the mouse because of the development of embryonic stem cells over time, and there has ways to knock out a specific gene if we want to know what this particular gene could do, has been done. And there, if we estimate that there are 30,000 genes in the mouse, perhaps maybe 2,000 of them have been knocked out. We'll say maybe a tenth of them have been knocked out. So that tells us, that gives us a handle, a way to figure out what each of these genes does in the eye, in the skin, in just every different part of an organism. And as I said, mouse and human genes are very much similar, and I think that this is the way that we're finding out what our human genes do.
Interesting. Let's go to Larry in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Larry, welcome to the program.
Hi, this is Larry, a colleague from Ann Arbor. I have a little background on C.C. Little. I'm a researcher at the medical school, and I used to work in a place called the Mouse House, which was Clarence Caldwell was the president of the University of Michigan for quite a while. And when he came here, they enticed him by giving him his own laboratory. And I worked there for a while, and it's since gone. It's been encroached in by the medical school. But it was called the Mendelian Genetics Building. I think the Balb-C mice was developed there.
Really?
And
Balb-C is one of the standard mouse
models.
Okay, go ahead.
Right. And, I worked there for a while. And, as a matter of fact, on the central campus of the University of Michigan, there is the C.C. Little Building. Clarence Caldwell Building. And, in terms of the animal rights issue, I work with mice in terms of models. I don't particularly like it, but, what do you got? I have a dog. I love animals. I've been trying to, we try to be humane to mice, but it's the model you got.
I got the point. Larry, thanks very much for the call. Maybe we could turn to you, Karen Rader, and talk a little bit more about Clarence Little. I mean, here's this guy. He starts off at Harvard, I think, goes to Maine, becomes the mm-hmm. president of the University of Maine. Mm-hmm. Then he goes to Michigan, becomes the president of the University of Michigan. So here's this, as you said, Brahmin, scholar, scientist, mm-hmm. administrator, and ultimately entrepreneur. How did he get from being a college a scientist to a college president to a mouse man?
There's a Michigan story there, too, because many of the people from the upper classes in Michigan used to vacation in Bar Harbor, Maine, where he would take his students for their summer trips to the laboratory on Mount Desert Island. So he would have his students there, and he would come in contact with what they called the summer colony. And many of these people, for example, Edsel Ford, and Roscoe B. Jackson were Michigan car makers.
and they supported a lot of his early... Roscoe
That's
Jackson,
right.
obviously, but the Fords. Why were the... Was it just friendship, or was there something about motor cars and production that got them interested?
I think there's an element of friendship. I think that, generally speaking, they were interested in giving money to curing disease, a very progressive cause for upper-class Americans during this period. But also, there are signs that they appreciated what Little called the business value of the proposition, the idea of standardization and having one place that's in charge of developing sort of the assembly line, the factory that makes the mice. So, I think it's a little bit of a lot of things, but in particular, just this group of people that he met and that were really interested in what he was doing and kind of gave him the faith to take on this enterprise.
Now, one of the things I noticed toward the end of his life, he had some curious, we can say, interests as well. He was interested in eugenics, and then at the end of his life, he took a job as a scientific consultant to the tobacco industry.
Right.
So what was up there?
I don't think eugenics... I think he was always interested in eugenics.
Okay.
Now, that said, so were many people in his generation. Most of the geneticists of the time were eugenicists of some stripe. That it didn't take on the bad connotations that it has now until after World War II, probably not even until the 60s. So eugenics was something that he was interested in. His position on that evolved from sort of at first becoming interested in maybe making recommendations to people about, breeding within cancerous families. But then as the data started coming out, and this was something he said all along as well, you have to pay attention to what the science is telling you, and the science is telling you that it's more complicated than a simple recommendation about dominance or recessive. So he became more interested in looking at things, as I said earlier, like susceptibility, and that was what the Tobacco Industry Research Council position was about. I really think he was a true believer that at some point there would be genetic knowledge that would help people make decisions about sort of what to do with their own heredity. But he was also pragmatic enough to recognize that, you know, we weren't there yet, even in 1960 when he took that job. So
fair enough. Let's take another call from Mary Beth this time. Mary Beth in Norfolk, Virginia. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Unfortunately, I've missed a lot of your show, but I'm calling just to make the point that these poor genetically engineered mice are so sick when they come into the commercial chain that it's almost laughable that the research community considers them decent subjects for research.
Well, can I just ask, Mary Beth, when you say they're sick, do you mean they're physically ill from being shipped to wherever they're going, or you mean they're sick because they're inbred?
Well, you know, the former point is a good one because they are sick from being shipped, but they are, I'm talking about the latter. They are so sick because they have been genetically engineered, manipulated to the point where they are now sick animals. You're starting with a sick animal, and you don't even know if the disease that you have tried to create in this animal is going to lend itself to the human condition. I mean, take, for instance, cystic fibrosis mouse. They have never been able to create a knockout mouse that adequately addresses the lung disease that kills 30,000 cystic fibrosis victims every year.
Okay, well, let's get an answer to that question. Barbara Knowles, maybe you can explain these inbred strains. They're obviously unusual in the sense that they're not like normal, quote-unquote, wild mice, but why are they useful? Or are they useful? Or, I mean, what about this genetic inbreeding point?
Well, the inbred strains themselves are not sick. The inbred strains themselves are more or less the controls, and most of them live an average lifespan for a mouse, and they are happy and healthy, rustling around and eating their food in the middle of the night. So the inbred strains aren't, and some of the mutations are created so that they can mimic these human diseases. And some of them are diseases that do happen in young mice, but many of them are diseases that don't happen into later life. For example, tumors that are formed later in life, and so they don't start out as sick mice. But it is true that some of them were created to study really dire diseases of the human condition, so that one can think about ways to manipulate them to cause cures or prevention.
We're talking about Mus musculus, the laboratory mouse. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's take another call. How about if we go to, let's see, Ron in Tempe, Arizona. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. I was running across some research recently, just based on some questions, and I ran across a mouse called the MRL mice, and how they were able to rejuvenate them. So this is naturally, this is not genetically engineered, this is a natural mouse that's able to rejuvenate its tissues, its organs, including its ear lobes, and et cetera. Could you elaborate on this? Because this is quite interesting, and I think the public needs to hear about this.
Barbara Knowles, go ahead.
Oh, sure. The MRL mouse is actually a mutant, but, I mean, that was just a spontaneously occurring mutation. So it does have a problem with a wound, not a problem. It's a good problem. They're able to heal wounds, and how people found that out is how one differentiates one mouse from another in these inbred strains is by making little holes in their ears like you do to pierce ears. And they found in this pesky strain of mouse that they couldn't figure out which mouse was which because they were healing up the holes that they had used to mark them. And then the studies have continued, and they are looking at ways to look at regeneration of areas of the heart when they're when wounds are intentionally made in the heart, just to determine how those healings happen. And now they're looking at the genetics of this mouse, trying to figure out what's going on with it.
Cool. Interesting. Let's go to Larry in, is it Port Huron, Michigan?
Port Huron.
Huron. Okay. Welcome to the program. What's your question?
Thank you. I was wondering, what was the greatest discovery or breakthrough that has come about through research with mice?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Let's think about that for a second. Maybe Karen Rader, do you want to take a shot at that?
Sure. I mean, I think that, for me, what's most striking is not any one discovery, but the sort of spectrum of discoveries across this organism. And so if you think about something like the inbred mouse on its own terms, certainly the mouse genome would be the thing that it's contributed. But if you think about using inbred mice as test subjects for chemotherapy drugs, can you pick one of those? I mean, not exactly, right? So I think there's a whole spectrum. And there are some things that, you know, that probably aren't as valuable. For example, research in cosmetic research and things like that. So I think, what you need to look at is not the single greatest discovery, but look at sort of the whole spectrum of discoveries that this organism has made possible.
Dr. Knowles, would you like to take a pick of the most important discovery?
I think my notion about what would be the most important is the discovery of embryonic stem cells, but we've really traced back many, many, many Nobel Prizes just to Little's original isogenic strains. So I think that's one possibility. Another is George Snell, who worked here for many, many years, won the Nobel Prize for understanding the major histocompatibility complex. And that is, not to go into any details about it, but no. It is what has allowed us to do transplantation therapies. So there are just lists of things that one could go on and on about, but...
Well, I sense that the mouse is a subject for much more time, but I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today. I'd like to thank my guests. First, Barbara Knowles is the Director of Research at the Jackson Laboratory in Bar Harbor, Maine. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
And Karen Rader is the Marilyn Simpson Chair of Science and Society at Sarah Lawrence College and author of Making Mice, Standardizing Animals for American Biomedical Research, 1900-1955. Published by Princeton University Press. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks, Joe.
When we come back, epigenetics. Stay with us.